Chapter 21. The next day at work, I stepped into the personnel office and had a chat with Alan Scheib, who had told Mrs. Sylvia that we were overstaffed. "Hire her," I told him.
"Doing what?"
"I need an assistant."
"I'll have to check with payroll and with Fleming and Teicher."
"Do it," I said. "And if you do, I owe you one. A favor."
"Business is business," Scheib said. "I'll do what I can. As a matter of fact, I think I owe you a favor. Anyhow, I'll try to swing it. What sort of wages?"
"That isn't important," I said. I could, after all, help finance her out of the funds I controlled, our under-the-table funds, so to speak, payoffs we did not report. In our confidential bookkeeping, Sadassa would be listed with a variety of local DJs. No one would be the wiser.
"You want me to interview her, see what she can do, so she thinks the job is legitimate?"
Scheib asked. "Fine," I said.
"You have her number?"
I did. I gave it to Scheib with instructions to say there was now a job opening and to come in to be interviewed. Just to make sure there was no foul-up, I telephoned her myself. "This is Nicholas Brady," I said when she answered, "at Progressive Records." "Oh, did I leave something behind? I can't find my..."
"I think we have a job for you," I said.
"Oh, well, I've decided I really don't want a job. I put in an application for a scholarship at Chapman College, and since I talked to you, they accepted my application, so now I can go back to school."
I was at a loss. "You won't come in," I said, "and be interviewed?"
"Tell me what kind of job it is. Filing and typing?"
"As my assistant."
"What would I do?"
I said, "Go with me to audition new performers."
"Oh."
She sounded interested. "And possibly we could use your lyrics."
"Oh, really?"
She perked up.
"Maybe I could do both. Go to school and that, too."
I had a strange feeling that in her guileless, innocent way, she had bumped us up 10 notches in the kind of job she could expect from us. This interchange gave me a different impression of her. Perhaps coping with and surviving cancer had taught her lessons, a certain kind of grit, a certain tenacity. And she had, probably, only a short time left to fulfill her needs, to extract whatever she was going to extract from life. "Please come in and talk to us about it," I said.
"Well, I could do that, I guess. I really should. I had a dream about your record company."
"Tell me." I listened intently.
Sadassa said, "I dreamed I was watching a recording session through the soundproof glass. I was thinking how wonderful the singer was, and I was impressed by all the professional mixers and mics, and then I saw the album jacket, and it was me. Sadassa Sylvia Sings, it was called."
"Honest," she laughed.
There wasn't much I could say. "And I got the strong impression," Sadassa continued, "when I woke up, that I'd be working for you, that the dream was a good omen."
"Yeah," I said, "most likely so."
"When should I come in?"
I told her at 4 o'clock today. That way I figured I could take her to dinner afterward.
"Have you had any other unusual dreams?" I asked on impulse. "That wasn't really unusual. What do you mean by unusual?"
"We can talk about it when you get here," I said.
Sadassa Sylvia showed up at 4 o'clock wearing a light brown jumpsuit, a yellow sweater, hooped earrings to match her afro-natural hair. She had a solemn expression on her face, as before. Seated across from me in my office, she said, "As I drove up here, I asked myself why you might be interested in any unusual dreams I have had. I keep a notebook for my shrink in which every morning I'm supposed to write down my dreams before I forget them. I've been doing that as long as I've been seeing Ed, which is almost 2 years."
"Tell me," I said.
"Do you want to know? Do you really want to?" "All right. I've had the feeling for 3 weeks now, it began on a Thursday, that someone is talking to me in my sleep."
"Man or woman?"
Sadassa said, "In between. It's a very calm voice, modulated. I only retain an impression of it when I wake up, but it's a favorable impression. The voice is very lulling. I always feel better after I've heard it."
"You can't remember anything it says?"
"Something about my cancer, that it won't come back."
"What time of night?"
"Exactly 3:30, Sadassa said. "I know because my boyfriend says I try to talk back to it. I mean, converse with it.
I wake him up by trying to talk, and he says it's always the same time of night. I'd forgotten about her boyfriend. Oh well, I said to myself, I have a wife and family. It's as if I'd left the radio on very low, Sadasa continued, to a faraway station, like you get on shortwave late at night. Amazing, I said. Sadasa said calmly, I came to Progressive Records in the first place because of a dream, very much like the one I had last night. I was in a lovely green valley with very high grass, out in the country, fresh and nice, and there was a mountain. I floated along, not on the ground, but weightlessly floating, and as I came toward the mountain it turned into a building. On the building they had put words, on a plaque over the entrance. Well, one word, Progressive. But in the dream I could tell it was Progressive Records, because I could hear the most incredibly dulcet music, not like any music I have ever heard in actuality. You did the right thing, I said, to act on that dream. Did I come to the right place? She studied my face intently. Yes, I said. You interpreted the dream right. You seem sure. What do I know? I said jokingly. I'm just glad you're here. I was afraid you wouldn't show up. I go to school. I will be going during the day. Can we audition performers at night? I would expect so. We have to fit the job in around my school schedule. You don't want much, I said, a little nettled. I've got to go to school again. I lost so much time while I was sick. Okay, I said, feeling guilty now. Sometimes, Sadasa said, I get the feeling that the government gave me cancer, gave me a carcinogen to deliberately make me sick. It's only by a miracle that I survived. Good God, I said, jolted. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe it was so, everything considered, with her background, with what she knew, what she was. Why would they want to do that?
I don't know. Why would they? I'm paranoid, I realize that. But strange things happen these days. Two of my friends have disappeared. I think they're sticking them in those camps.
My phone rang. I picked it up and found myself talking to Rachel. Her voice shook with excitement.
Nick!
I'm with a client, I said.
Have you seen today's LA Times?
No, I said.
Go get it. You have to read it. Page 3, the right-hand column.
Tell me what it says, I said.
You've got to read it. It explains the experiences you've been having. Please, Nick, go look at it. It really does.
Okay, I said. Thanks. I hung up. Excuse me, I said to Sadasa. I have to go out front to the newspaper thing. I left my office, went down the hall to the big outside glass doors. A moment later, I had a copy of the Times and was carrying it back, reading it as I walked. On page 3 in the right-hand column, I found this article. Soviet astrophysicist reports radio signals from intelligent life. Not from outer space, as expected, but emanating close to Earth. Standing there in the hall, I read the article. The foremost Soviet astrophysicist, Georgi Moyashka, using a collection of interlinked radio telescopes, had picked up what he believed to be deliberate signals from a sentient life form. These signals containing the characteristics that Moyashka had anticipated finding. The big surprise, however, was their point of origin, within our solar system, which no one, including Moyashka himself, had anticipated. The U.S. space people had already gone on record as saying that the signals undoubtedly emanated from old satellites put into space and then forgotten, but Moyashka was certain that the signals were of alien origin. So far, he and his team had been unable to decode them. The signals came in short bursts from a moving source that seemed to be circling Earth, perhaps 6,000 miles away. They came on an unexpected ultra-high frequency, rather than as shortwave emissions with greater carrying distance. The transmitter appeared to be powerful. One odd point that Moyashka had noted, which he could not account for, was the fact that the radio signals came only when the source was above Earth's dark or night side. During the day, the signals ceased. Moyashka conjectured that the so-called heaviside layer might be involved. The signals, although short in duration, seemed highly information-rich because of their sophistication and complexity. Curiously, the frequency changed periodically, a phenomenon found in transmissions seeking to avoid jamming, Moyashka stated. Further, his team had discovered, entirely by accident, that animals in their Pulkovo laboratory underwent slight but regular physical changes during the time of signal transmission. Their blood volume altered and their blood pressure readings increased. Provisionally, Moyashka conjectured that radiation accompanying the radio signals might account for it. The Soviets, the article finished, planned to launch a satellite of their own to intercept the orbit of this Earth-rotating transmitter, to confirm their theory that it was a satellite not of terrestrial origin. They hoped to photograph it. From the payphone in the hall, I called Rachel back. "I read it," I said. "But Phil and I already have a theory." Bitingly, Rachel said, "This isn't a theory, this is fact. I heard it on the noon news, too. It's real, even if we deny it. The U.S. denies it. I looked up Dr. Moyashka in your Britannica. There's an article on him. He discovered volcanic activity on the moon and some kind of thing on Mercury. I didn't understand it, but every time people said he was wrong or crazy. Stalin had him in a forced labor camp for years. He's highly esteemed. He's a big wheel in the Russian space program. And the radio today says he heads their SETI project, contacting extraterrestrial intelligence. They're using telepathy and everything. They're really wild."
"Did the radio say how long they think the satellite's been transmitting?"
"The Russians just picked it up recently. They don't know anything about before that. But listen, short, intense, high-frequency bursts, always at night. Don't you receive your pictures and words around 3 a.m.? It fits, Nick, it does. You and Phil were thinking anyhow maybe it's a satellite orbiting Earth. I remember both of you talking about that."
"Our new theory," I began.
"The hell with your new theory," Rachel said. "This is the biggest news in the history of the world. I think you'd be out of your mind with excitement."
"I am," I said. "Catch you later." I hung up and returned to my office, where Sadasa Sylvia sat, smoking a cigarette and reading a magazine. "Sorry to keep you waiting," I said to her.
"The phone rang while you were out of the office," Sadasa said. "I didn't think I should answer it."
"It'll ring again," I said. The phone rang. I picked it up and said hello. It was Phil. He had heard the news on the radio. Like Rachel, he was highly excited. "I read about it in the Times," I informed him.
"Did the Times article mention that it broadcasts on the same frequencies our FM and TV sound travels on?" Phil said. "The scientist I heard commenting from some U.S. space laboratory says that virtually rules out the possibility that it's one of our own satellites, since ours don't broadcast on commercial frequencies. Listen, Nick, he said its signals would interfere with FM and TV reception, so we might have to destroy it. But what I was thinking, remember when you heard that weird shit on your radio at night as if it were talking to you, and we conjectured about a satellite override? Nick, this may be it. This thing, when it transmits, might very well override. And the scientist said, the one I heard commenting, that it doesn't broadcast in the strict sense of the word, that it's narrow, tight beams, directed. Broadcast means in all directions, everywhere equally. This satellite's signals don't propagate in all..."
"Phil," I broke in, "I've got somebody with me right now. Can I get back to you tonight?"
"Sure," Phil said, mollified. "But you know, Nick, this could explain it. It really could. You're transducing these unusual alien signals."
"Catch you later, Phil," I said, and hung up. I did not want to discuss it in front of Sadasa Sylvia, or anyone else for that matter. Although, I thought, I may be discussing it with Ms. Sylvia one of these days, when the time is right, when I've sounded her out sufficiently beforehand. Sadasa said, "Was it the article in the Times about prisons are a source of wealth? That pitch for slave labor under the guise of psychological rehabilitation? Convicts need not be indoors, wasting years of their lives in idleness. Rather, they could..." "Let's see, how did they put it? Convicts could work out under the warm sun in labor groups, rebuilding slums, contributing to urban renewal, and hippies could make their contribution to society, side by side with them, and also the youth who can't get jobs. I felt like writing in to say, and when they die of overwork and starvation, they can contribute their bodies in giant ovens, and we can melt them down into useful bars of soap."
"No," I said, "it wasn't that article."
"The alien satellite, then?"
Presently, I nodded. Sadasa said,
"It's a fake. Or rather, it's one of ours, and we won't admit it. It's a propaganda satellite we use to beam down subliminal material to the Soviet people. That's why it broadcasts on commercial FM and TV frequency and alters its transmission frequency at random intervals. The Soviet people get eighth of a second stills of happy Americans eating all the food they want, shit like that. The Russians know it, and we know it. They beam down to us from unauthorized satellites, and we do the same to them. They're going to shoot it down. That's what they're up to. I don't blame them." It sounded convincing, except that it scarcely explained why the Soviet Union's foremost astrophysicist would make the announcement he had made, Mayashka had put his vast reputation on the line again, claiming the satellite to be extraterrestrial in origin. It seemed doubtful that a man of his probity would become embroiled in a strictly political matter. "Do you really think a famous scientist like Yorgi Mayashka would—" I began, but Sadasa, in her gentle but strict little voice, interrupted imperturbably.
"He does what they tell him. All Soviet scientists do and say what they're told. Ever since Topchiev purged the Soviet Academy of Sciences back in the 50s, he was the party hatchet man in the Academy then, its official secretary. He personally sent to prison hundreds of the USSR's top scientists. That's why their space program is so clunky, so far behind ours. They haven't even managed to miniaturize their components. They have no microcircuitry at all."
"Well," I said, nonplussed, "but in some areas—"
"Big booster rockets," Sadasa agreed. "They're still using tubes. The average stereo built in Japan is more advanced than the components used in a Soviet missile."
"Let's get down to the business of your job," I said.
"All right,"
she nodded sensibly. "We can't pay you very much," I said, "but the work should be interesting."
"I don't need much," Sadasa said. "How much is much?"
I wrote down a figure and turned it to show her.
"That certainly isn't much," she said. "For how many hours a week?"
30 hours, I said.
"I guess I could work that into my schedule."
Exasperated, I said, "I don't think you're being realistic. For that few hours, it's good pay, and you're unskilled. This isn't typing and filing. This is creative work. I'd have to train you. I think it's a good deal. You should be glad to get it."
"What about publishing my lyrics and using them?"
"We'll use them, if they're good enough."
"I brought some along."
She opened her purse and brought out an envelope.
"Here."
Opening the envelope, I removed 4 pieces of paper, on which she had written verses in blue fountain pen ink. Her handwriting was legible but shaky, the after effects of her illness. I read over the poems. They were poems, not lyrics. But my mind was on what she had just said. The Soviet Union was going to do what? Shoot the satellite down? What then would become of me? Where would my help come from? "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm having trouble concentrating. They're very good." I said it reflexively, without conviction. Maybe they were good, maybe not. All I could think of was the dreary, heartbreaking thing she had told me, her conjecture about Soviet intentions. It seemed obvious now that she had uttered it. Of course they weren't merely going to photograph the alien satellite. Of course they were going to shoot it down. They weren't going to allow an extraterrestrial vehicle, an intruder into our button-down world, to beam split-second subliminal communications to our people, overriding our own managed TV and FM transmissions, adding God knew what information we weren't supposed to know. "Radio Free Alpha Centauri," I said to myself bitterly. "Radio Free Albemuth," as I had come to call it. "How long are you going to last now that you've been found out? They can't get you with a missile. They will launch a satellite with an H-warhead and simply detonate you in the general blast. No more tight-beamed messages. And, I thought, no more dreams for me." "Can I take these poems home?" I asked Sadasa, "and read them more leisurely?"
"Of course," she said. "Hey," she said suddenly, "what upset you? The poem about my lymphoma? Was that it? Most people are upset by that. I wrote it when I was so sick. You can tell by the content. I didn't expect to live."
"Yeah," I said. "That's what did it."
"I shouldn't have shown that to you."
"It's a very powerful poem," I said. "I'm not sure, frankly, how a poem about someone having cancer could be adapted to use as lyrics for a song. It certainly would be a first." We both tried to smile. Neither of us made it.
"The others aren't so heavy,"
Sadasa said. She reached out and patted me on the hand.
"Maybe you could use one of them."
"I'm sure we can," I said. What a charming, unhappy girl, I thought, struggling against such odds.